Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
Well, good afternoon. We're going to be going over the parasha section. It's called Vayakhel. Vayakhel. And he assembled. And what we're going to be talking about today is what he assembled the people to hear. So we're going to be going over Exodus 35 through most of chapter 38. And a couple of key things to take a look at as we go through here are, you know, what actions are involved with making of the tabernacle? Because most of what we're going to be looking at today is involved with the construction of the tabernacle. Yet the section that we're looking at today starts off with another discussion of Shabbat. We had one in our last parasha discussion where we talked a lot about Shabbat and what's involved with that. But here it shows up again right before we get into this discussion about the making of the tabernacle. And one of the things that we'll also be asking is, what does this mean to me? What does this mean to me today? You know, some people might think that's kind of the wishy-washy sort of approach to looking at this, but truly, it's a question that we should be asking every time we go through the Word, because we don't want to be into the trap of what happened in later generations of our forefathers when they were facing the exiles and the things of God became rote, became just something that they did, and their hearts were far away from where God was. So even though they were working with God's house, their hearts weren't at God's house. They were somewhere else. Their devotion was somewhere else. So as we go through here and we're talking about everything that goes into the making of the tabernacle, should be taking a look at what is the lesson in this. So chapter 35. Then Moshe assembled all the congregation of the sons of Israel and said to them, "These are the things that the Lord has commanded for you to do. For 6 days work may be done, but on the seventh day you are to have a holy day, a Sabbath of complete rest to the Lord. Whoever does any work on it shall be put to death. You shall not kindle a fire in any of your dwellings on the Shabbat day." Moshe spoke to all the congregation of the sons of Israel, saying, "This is the thing that the Lord has commanded, saying, take from among you a contribution to the Lord. Whoever is of a willing heart, let him bring it to the Lord's contribution, gold, silver, and bronze, and purple, and blue, and scarlet material, fine linen, goat's hair, and ram skin dyed red, porpoise skins, and acacia wood, and oil for lighting, and spices for the anointing oil, and fragrant incense, and onyx stones and setting stones for the ephod and the breastpiece. Let every skillful man among you come and make all that the Lord commanded: the tabernacle, its tent and its covering, its hooks and its boards, its bars, its pillars, and its sockets, the ark and its poles, the mercy seat and the curtain of the screen, the table and its poles and all its utensils, and the bread of the presence, the lampstand also for the light, and its utensils and its lamps, and the oil for the light, and the altar of incense and its poles, and the anointing oil of the fragrant incense on the screen of the doorway at the entrance of the tabernacle, the altar of burnt offering with its bronze grating and poles and all its utensils, the basin and its stand, the hangings of the court, its pillars and its sockets, and the screen for the gate of the court, pegs of the tabernacle and the pegs of the court and their cords, the woven garments for ministering in the holy place, and the holy garments for Aharon the priest, and garments of his sons to minister as priests. Then all the congregation of the sons of Israel departed from Moshe's presence, everyone whose heart stirred him, and everyone whose spirit moved him, came and brought the Lord's contribution for the work of the tent of meeting, for all its service, and for the holy garments. Then all whose hearts moved them, both men and women, came and brought brooches and earrings and signet rings and bracelets, all articles of gold. So did every man who presented an offering of gold to the Lord. Every man who had in his possession blue and purple and scarlet material and fine linen of goat's hair and ram skins, dyed red and porpoise skins, and brought them. Everyone who could make a contribution of silver and bronze brought the Lord's contribution. And every man who had it in his possession, acacia wood for any work of the service, brought it. All the skilled women spun with their hands and brought what they had spun in blue and purple and scarlet material and in fine linen. All the women whose hearts stirred with a skill spun the goat's hair. The rulers brought the onyx stones and the stones for the setting of the ephod and for the breastplate. And the spice for the oil, and the oil for the light, and for the anointing oil for the fragrant incense. Then the people of Israel, all the men and women whose heart moved them to bring material for all the work which the Lord had commanded through Moshe to be done, brought a free will offering to the Lord. Then Moshe said to the sons of Israel, "See, the Lord is called by name Bezalel, the son of Uri, the son of Hur, of the tribe of Yehuda, and he's filled them with the Spirit of God in wisdom, in understanding, and in knowledge, and in all craftsmanship, to make designs for working in gold and in silver and in bronze, and in the cutting of stones for settings and for the carving of wood, so as to perform in every inventive work. He also has brought in his He who also has put in his heart to teach, both he and Oholiab, the son of Ahisamach, the son of the tribe of Dan. He has filled them with skill to perform every work of an engraver, of a designer, of an embroiderer, in blue and purple and scarlet material, and in fine linen, and of a weaver, as performers of every work and makers of designs." Chapter 36. Now, Bezalel and Oholiab and every skillful person in whom the Lord has put skill and understanding to know how to perform all the work in the construction of the sanctuary shall perform in accordance with all that the Lord has commanded. Then Moshe called Bezalel and Oholiab and every skillful person in whom the Lord has put skill, everyone whose heart stirred him, to come to the work to perform it. They received from Moshe all the contributions which the sons of Israel had brought to perform the work in the construction of the sanctuary, and they still continued bringing to him freewill offerings every morning. And all the skillful men who were performing all the work of the sanctuary came, each from the work which he was performing. And they said to Moshe, "The people are bringing much more than enough for the construction work which the Lord has commanded us to perform." So Moshe issued a command, and a proclamation was circulated throughout the camp, saying, "Let no man or woman any longer perform any work of the contributions of the sanctuary." Thus the people were restrained from bringing any more. For the material that they had was sufficient and more than enough to perform the work. All the skillful men among those who were performing the work made the tabernacle with 10 curtains of fine twisted linen and purple and scarlet material, with cherubim, the work of a skilled workman. Bezalel made them. The length of each curtain was 28 cubits, and the width of each curtain was 4 cubits. All the curtains had the same measurements. He joined 5 curtains to one another, and the other 5 curtains he joined to one another. He made loops of blue on the edge of the outermost curtain in the first set. He did likewise on the edge of the curtain that was the outermost of the second set. He made 50 loops in one curtain, and he made 50 loops on the edge of the curtain that was in the second set. The loops were opposite each other. He made 50 clasps of gold and joined the curtains to one another with the clasps. So the tabernacle was a unit. Then he made curtains of gold, of goat's hair, for a tent over the tabernacle. He made 11 curtains in all. The length of each curtain was 30 cubits and 4 cubits in the width of each curtain. The 11 curtains had the same measurements. He joined the 5 of the curtains by themselves and the other 6 curtains by themselves. Moreover, he made 50 loops on the edge of the curtain that was the outermost in the first set, and he made 50 loops on the edge of the curtain that was the outermost set in the second set. He made 50 clasps of bronze to join the tent together so that it would be a unit. He made a covering for the tent of ram skin dyed red, and a covering of porpoise skins above. Then he made the boards for the tabernacle of acacia wood standing upright. 10 cubits was the length of each board, and 1.5 cubits the width of each board. There were 2 tenons for each board, fitted into one another. Thus he did for all the boards of the tabernacle. He made the boards of the tabernacle, 20 boards for the south side, and made 20 sockets of silver under the 20 boards. 2 sockets under one board for its 2 tenons, and 2 sockets under another board for its 2 tenons. Then, for the second side of the tabernacle, on the north side, he made 20 boards, and there are 40 sockets of silver, 2 sockets under one board and 2 sockets under another. For the rear of the tabernacle, to the west, he made 6 boards. He made 2 boards for the corners of the tabernacle at the rear. They were double beneath, and together they were complete to its top, to the first ring. Thus he did with both of them for the 2 corners. There were 8 boards with their sockets of silver, 16 sockets, 2 under each board. Then he made bars of acacia wood, 5 for the boards of one side of the tabernacle, and 5 bars for the boards of the other side of the tabernacle, and 5 bars for the boards of the tabernacle for the rear side to the west. He made the middle bar to pass through the center of the boards from end to end. He overlaid the boards with gold and made the rings of gold as holders for the bars, and overlaid the bars with gold. Moreover, he made the veil of blue and purple and scarlet material, the fine twisted linen, and he made it with cherubim, the work of a skillful workman. He made 4 pillars of acacia for it, and overlaid them with gold, with their hooks of gold, and he cast 4 sockets of silver for them. He made a screen for the doorway of the tent, of blue and purple and scarlet material, fine twisted linen, the work of a weaver. And he made its 5 pillars with their hooks, and he overlaid the tops of their bands with gold, but their 5 sockets were of bronze. Chapter 37. Now Bezalel made the ark of acacia wood. Its length was 2.5 cubits, and its width 1.5 cubits, and its height 1.5 cubits. And he overlaid it with pure gold inside and out, and made a gold molding for it all around. He cast 4 rings of gold for it on its 4 feet, and even 2 rings on one side of it, and 2 rings on the other side of it. He made poles of acacia wood and overlaid them with gold, and he put 2 poles into the rings on the sides of the ark to carry it. He made a mercy seat of pure gold, 2.5 cubits long and 1.5 cubits wide. He made 2 cherubim of gold. He made them of hammered work at the 2 ends of the mercy seat, 1 cherub at one end and 1 cherub at the other end. He made the cherubim of 1 piece with the mercy seat at 2 ends. The cherubim had their wings spread upward, covering the mercy seat with their wings, with their faces toward each other. The faces of the cherubim were toward the mercy seat. Then he made the table of acacia wood, 2 cubits long and 1 cubit wide, and 1.5 cubits high. He overlaid it with pure gold and made its gold molding for it all around. He made a rim for it, a handbreadth all around, and made a gold molding for its rim all around. He cast 4 gold rings for it and put the rings on the 4 corners that were on its 4 feet. Close by the rim were the rings, the holders of the poles to carry the table. He made the poles of acacia wood and overlaid them with gold to carry the table. He made the utensils which were on the plate, its dishes and its pans and its bowls and its jars, with which to pour out the drink offering. He made them of pure gold. Then he made the lampstand of pure gold. He made the lampstand of hammered work. Its base and its shaft, its cups, its bulbs, and its flowers were of one piece with it. There were 6 branches going out of its sides. 3 branches of the lampstand were on one side, and 3 branches of the lampstand were on the other side. 3 cups were shaped like almond blossoms. A bulb and a flower in 1 branch, and 3 cups shaped like almond blossoms. A bulb and a flower in the other branch, so for the 6 branches going out of the lampstand. In the lampstand, there were 4 cups shaped like almond blossoms, its bulbs and its flowers. And a bulb was under the 1st pair of branches coming out of it, and a bulb under the 2nd pair of branches coming out of it, and a bulb under the 3rd pair of branches coming out of it. For 6 branches coming out of the lampstand. Their bulbs and their branches were of one piece with it. The whole of it was a single hammered work of pure gold. He made its 7 lamps with its snuffers and its trays of pure gold. He made it and its utensils from a talent of pure gold. Then he made the altar of incense of acacia wood, 1 cubit long, 1 cubit wide, square, and 2 cubits high. Its horns were of 1 piece with it. He overlaid that with pure gold, its top and its sides all around, and its horns, and he made a gold molding for it all around. He made 2 golden lampstands for it under its molding and on its 2 sides, on opposite sides, as holders for the poles with which to carry it. He made the poles of acacia wood and overlaid them with gold. And he made the holy anointing oil and the pure fragrant incense of spices, the work of a perfumer. Chapter 38. Then he made the altar burnt incense, a burnt offering of acacia wood, 5 cubits long and 5 cubits wide, square, and 3 cubits high. He made its horns on its 4 corners, its horns being of 1 piece with it, and he overlaid it with bronze. He made all the utensils of the altar, the pails and the shovels and the basins, the flesh hooks and the fire pans. He made all of it out of bronze. He made for the altar a grating of bronze network beneath, under its ledge, reaching halfway up. He cast 4 rings on its 4 ends of the bronze grating as holders for the poles. He made poles of acacia wood and overlaid them with bronze. He inserted the poles into the rings of the sides of the altar with which to carry it. He made it hollow with planks. Moreover, he made a laver of bronze, and with its base of bronze, from the mirrors of the serving women who were served at the doorway of the tent of meeting. Then he made the court. For the south side, the hangings of the court were of fine twisted linen, 100 cubits. There are 20 pillars, and there are 20 sockets he made of bronze. The hooks of the pillars and their bands were of silver. In the north side, there were 100 cubits. There are 20 pillars, and their 20 sockets were of bronze. The hooks of the pillars and their bands were of silver. The west side, there were hangings of 50 cubits. There are 10 pillars and their 10 sockets. and the hooks of the pillars and their bands were of silver. For the east side, 50 cubits. The hangings of the one side of the gate were 15 cubits, and their three pillars and their three sockets. And so for the south, for the other side. On both sides of the gate of the court were hangings of 15 cubits, with their three pillars and their three sockets. All the hangings of the court all around were fine twisted linen. The sockets of the pillars were of bronze, the hooks of the pillars and their bands of silver, and the overlaying of their tops of silver, and all the pillars of the court were furnished with silver bands. The screen of the gate of the court was the work of a weaver of blue and purple and scarlet material and fine twisted linen. And the length was 20 cubits, and the height was 5 cubits, corresponding to the hangings of the court. Their four pillars and their four sockets were of bronze, their hooks were of silver, and the overlaying of their tops and their bands were of silver. All the pegs of the tabernacle and of the court all around were of bronze. All right, that is the conclusion of the passage we're going through. Are there any insights or thoughts any of you folk had as you were going through it that might be kind of good to take a look at first off? Yes.
I told you about this before, but I looked up the numbers in according with this, and you're not really into that, but I don't get into it when it's foo-foo stuff, but it was actually describing being built. The numbers was describing building the tabernacle. It was really amazing. And another thing I wanted to, what is the slaughter place for, and why is it bronze?
You're talking about the place where
chapter 38, where it says, and he made the, well, my scripture says slaughter place, and you called it burnt something, burnt offerings.
Oh, the altar for the burnt offering?
Yeah, and it's made of brazen, of bronze?
Yes. Well, or another, it's commonly included in the word, that it's a word that could be in copper or bronze, brass sort of thing, but it's definitely gives you the idea of the reddishness to it.
Okay. Because I was thinking when I was reading that Moses had to make a serpent of bronze.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if that has something, the bronze means something with his tabernacle and why it's bronze.
Bronze indeed does. Daniel went over this quite a bit. If you go back and you take a look at the parallel passage as when he was going over, I believe it was what, 1 Kings 7, 6 and 7, where it talks about the Solomon's designed for it. Solomon had he multiplied a number of things, the numbers of things considerably. Instead of one menorah, he had 10. Instead of one table of the presence, he had 10. And there was a number of things that he put on it, such as ornaments of pomegranates, and the number of pomegranates. Daniel went into a lot of what the prophetic significance of that was, kind of looking at the time frame of the when the exiles were coming, how many kings were be involved in the nation. But one of the things related to bronze and brass is that pay attention to where they are in the tabernacle. And Daniel talks a lot about that with the location of them out in the courtyard area. And one thing, when I was talking about the reddish color of them, that's kind of gives you a little bit of a hint, because one of the things we talk about blood being dam. Dam is the Hebrew word for blood. And it's kind of a nice play on words, because Adam, or dirt or ground and such, that's, man. So it's a very interesting play on words of mankind and blood and copper and that being red. So very interesting. There's also some very interesting stuff that's, may have nothing to do with it, but it's a fun little coincidence that people have been looking at the amazing property of copper to be almost like an alchemist of sorts. That if you apply the right amount of energy, which we're talking a lot of energy to copper, you can make all kinds of things out of it. spring out of it. So very amazing properties of copper. Of course, we use copper in electrical stuff all the time, and we use gold, and we use silver for a lot of this stuff. Very interesting. Not just pretty, but it also does quite a lot, has a lot of properties that we, you know, in modern times we've only just started to scratch the surface of. Yeah, silver is it's a lot of silver in electronics and modern electronics and stuff. So very, very interesting. Bracelet of copper, silver.
Yeah, and oh, hi. And the bracelets do something with energy. It helps the body somehow.
Okay.
But
right.
It's really, I tried one of those on, and my arm, I could feel weird energy in my arm that whole day, and it was weird.
Yeah, well, you know, if you've ever played around electronics, you know, you'll notice this great thing about grounding. So the human body with its electrical field that you can even take pictures of nowadays, but you can also, it interacts with other electrical fields. So yes, it is quite interesting when you've got conducting materials around an electrical sort of thing, what can happen with that. Yes, can happen for good or bad. So any other observations as we're going through on the kind of descriptions of the tabernacle? You know, another thing we're talking about, the talent, but something else to keep in mind is when we're talking about a cubit, we've mentioned this in the past a bit, there's some variations on the length of a cubit, and you see later on in Israel's history, they talk about standard cubits or such like that, and you get the picture that that standard cubit, at least later on in Israel's history, was probably somewhere around 20 or maybe more inches long. But sometimes they think of cubit, and coming from Middle Ages time period, is 18 inches long. So it could be anywhere from 18 inches to like 20, even maybe 22 inches or something like that. So when you're talking about these many cubits, it's you're talking about a pretty good sized thing. It's at least, you know, 150 feet long by what, 75 feet wide, at least, probably more. And when you're talking about the screen, and you're talking about the poles, the perimeter, that's at least 6 feet tall, and most likely probably maybe 6'8" around it. So the idea is that when you think of median heights of people over time, you got the outliers like Goliath, but mostly throughout time, people have tended to be in the 5 to 6 foot range, for men at least. So you got something that's 6'8", it's going to keep your vision blocked. So when you're coming across the tabernacle, you're going to be seeing mostly the screen. But thankfully, he gave a very nice screen to look at, because, you know, with its curtains made of very fine linen, plus the brass or bronze or copper hooks on it, plus the silver hooks on it. So very nice thing to look at. Any other observations from the construction of the tabernacle? Look at one of the things. Oh yes, we got another observation.
Well, I like how we make everything portable. Everything fits into holes, and it all comes back together. And it's all. I mean, you can learn how to make portable things by this.
Yes,
because of how smart he was. Of course, he was smart.
Yeah. Well, when they talk about the guy that was given, you know, the spirit of wisdom and understanding and skill and craftsmanship, that's quite amazing. You know, to make something that fits together and takes apart, and you're going to be doing that repeatedly. Because when you think about some, you might have put together something that comes in lots of pieces, maybe something quite big. And you know what can happen if there was not any sort of care at the factory in how they milled the holes or line things up, and then you're left with things that don't fit together correctly. You know, because what does that reflect upon? If you get something that is not made correctly, it just makes you think less of that item. So if you're talking about the house that is to be you'd say the embassy of God on earth, that it's the way it's put together, the skill that is put together, and its impressiveness is a testimony of what you might expect inside. Any other observations? When the thing also to note with this, and when they talked about these folk who were given this special spirit of wisdom, that's at the beginning of chapter 36, talks about Bezalel and Oholiab. They were given this skill and understanding, and at one point also they talk about wisdom. So it's interesting. We think of, you know, wisdom, oh, getting this great revelation about the things of God, but there's also wisdom in knowing how things should work. And really, when you see, you look through Proverbs, and it talks about wisdom, get chokhmah. That is more than just, oh, get to know, you know, how to recite things, know where to find stuff in the Bible and this and that. This is more of how to actually get through life, which is why there's a key part in Proverbs where it starts connecting that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of chokhmah. It's the beginning of wisdom. It's the beginning of understanding. Because whether you're doing, you know, whether you're, you know, programming or building a house or whatever it is that you're doing, that's where you also get the thing in Ecclesiastes, like whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might, and also work as if you're working for the Lord. Because that is kind of the thing that puts everything into context. And kind of what we were mentioning at the outset of this discussion is that what does this mean to me? Not just what we can sort of change these words into to fit our understanding today, but what does this mean as we read these words? What does that mean for us and how we go about our life? Any other observations before we kind of move on into some of these bigger topic discussions? All right. Well, one of the things that I was asking you before we started reading is, you know, the actions that are involved in making this. And we notice at the beginning part of this in chapter 35, the first three verses are talking about Shabbat. When our last parasha, we were talking about Shabbat and had a good discussion of all the things related to malach, you know, what you're going to be working, doing, what labor is, what work is. And here it comes about again before you get into this discussion of what work is. Now, yeah, you may have heard people talk about the categories of work, or as it's referred to, sages talk about the avot of work. Now, you know, people have their ideas about what sages are, what they say, but really it's no different than what people who have been kind of reflecting upon things over time have thought about and come to conclusions or even debated over. I mean, you'll see those in the believers in Messiah over time have taken a look at what the word is, seen what it means. What does this apply to us today? People throughout in the Mishnah and the Talmud, they took a stab at things and what that means. You know, we can. It's one of the key lessons that Messiah brought as you go through the Gospels is when you go through and you consider those traditions of the elders. You have to keep them in their proper context. They are traditions. They go to places that Scripture does not cover specifically. Because, as we'll take a look in this, Scripture does not talk a lot about what is and what isn't work on Shabbat. We got some kind of key examples of gathering sticks and things like that, but beyond that, no, we don't. Except that We've got this thing, our last discussion, we're talking about what the priests do, and also in this passage here, we've got the things related to the building of the tabernacle. So when you talk about those 39 categories or the fathers of what work means and such, this is the passage where they come from. So what we're going to do is just go through those. Again, this is tradition. This is people's thoughts over time about it. But one of the things that we should look for is just starting as a starting point for thinking. And another good reason to go through them is that a number of these things show up in the Gospels. A number of the things that Yeshua and the apostles were getting raked over the coals over are involved in the list that we're going to go through. And we'll note a lot of key important thoughts that Yeshua said about how to keep things in perspective, that we are talking about tradition. Tradition, you know, a lot of people think of tradition as a boogeyman. Tradition is simply how you take God's words where they end and put them into the world around you. You can do that in a bad way, where you actually make God's words fall down, or you can do them in a good way, where you lift God's words up, you draw people to God, you're not taking away from what God says. So that's always the balance that you go through. And when you read the Gospels, especially like the Sermon on the Mount, you know, Matthew chapter 5 through 7, you've heard it said, but I tell you, you've heard it said, but I tell you. That's a lot of that, you know, you could say tightening the screws on the traditions of the elders to say, okay, here's what people are putting forward and taking where God's word stopped and saying, okay, this is how you put it into life. And have they done so in a way that destroys what God's word says? So as we get all that going, let's take a look at the first three verses of chapter 35 of Exodus. We got these first three verses that say here, he assembled everybody together. These are the things that the Lord has commanded you to do. So it's like, these are the things. And he starts out there with Shabbat. For in 6 days, work may be done, but on the seventh day, you have a holy day. This is a Sabbath of complete rest. Or as you might have heard, the reference to, there's two references or two main categories of places where you see this, the Shabbat, Shabbaton, which is where we get the translation complete rest. It's like you stop, 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 stop. So that's kind of where the Shabbat, Shabbaton is translated as complete rest comes from. So you get that with the seventh day, Shabbat, and then you also get that with Yom HaKippurim or Yom Kippur, where those are the ones classified as the Shabbat Shabbaton. This is a complete rest. You're not doing stuff. And Yom Kippur takes that Shabbat Shabbaton even further. And you see that in Leviticus chapter 16. But in this context, we see those as talking about, there's couple of things. We get the one that we've seen like in Deuteronomy 5 and Exodus 20 with, you know, in 6 days work may be done, but on the seventh day you shall have this Shabbat Shabbaton. And then we got the other one in verse 3, well, you may not kindle a fire in any of your dwellings on the Sabbath day. So that's where we get this start. And this is the start of the discussion of building the tabernacle. And what is the tabernacle? This ohel moed, or the tent of meeting, the tents of appointments with God. That is the place. The tabernacle is the place where you have this appointment with God, where you meet with God. So Shabbat, kind of connected to that, is the, you could say, a time where you're having an appointment with God. You've got all of the moedim, the appointed times, these appointments. But this Shabbat is also part of that. And it encapsulates a lot of what's going on with the tabernacle. So, not so coincidentally, when you look into the letter to the Hebrews, chapters 3 and 4 in Hebrews are about what? Rest, rest, enter my rest, not enter my rest. I'm going to give you complete rest. And then it goes on from there into discussions a few chapters later in Hebrews about Yom Kippur. And so you've got Shabbat and Yom Kippur show up a lot along with this discussion of the priesthood and the tabernacle and what's going on in the tabernacle. So this idea of Shabbat and the tabernacle fit together. Because you think about it, every seventh day you have God's tabernacle of time. It rolls around no matter if you're at the physical tabernacle, if it exists or not, that tabernacle arrives. And it's very, very kind of interesting picture where you've got in Hebrews where it quotes from Psalm 95 about, I swore my wrath, they will not enter my rest. And as you see in the discussion of the tabernacle, the last thing you see discussed is toward the end of this passage we just read was what? About the door. So just like entering the tabernacle, are you going to enter? Okay, this whole thing has been described. Are you actually going to go in? So in a similar way, you've got in Hebrews where it describes, okay, describing all this thing about rest and God's wanting to provide rest, and you see it compared to entering the land and the land being provided rest. Then you started the discussion in chapter 4 of Hebrews about the Shabbat itself being a symbol of the rest that God is providing. So do you actually want to go in? God provides the place. Do you actually want to enter it? So as we go forward with this, one of the things that are divided down into these, and you can, if you want to see somebody stab at this from maybe kind of the early time period, it's recorded in the Mishnah, so it's somewhere, 300 to 600, maybe 300 to 800 AD. So how far back that goes before that, we don't know, but we'll see a number of these things as we go through in the Gospels. So these ideas were floating around long before 300 AD. And we'll even see mention of it in one of the, quote, church fathers, unquote, in early 200 or early 100, I mean. So it was going back at least that far. So we'll see that some of these ideas go back quite a ways. And so if you're interested in looking up more of this, this is in Tractate Shabbat in the Mishnah, in section 7. They are divided all kinds of different ways, but, and they're divided into kind of like roughly, you could say a couple of major boat areas. You've got, as we were kind of going through the tabernacle, they're divided into like the field to the loaf. You know, what is, when you think about the bread of the presence, what is required to get it to the bread of the presence? Everything that's involved with getting it that far. We talk about bringing the loaves. We mentioned that in the previous parasha, going back a couple, about the bringing in the loaves of the bread of the presence. So what's involved with that? And the next major bucket is about, there's all this discussion about sheep, and we talked about the burnt offering. What's involved with getting the sheep into the sheets? We talked about all these curtains and stuff, so we get not only the altar, but all the curtains that go over the tabernacle and around the tabernacle. What's involved with getting it from your sheep or your crop or where you have your linen that you might get the cotton from, or you're talking about the wool that you're getting from the sheep? What's involved with getting it from wool to linen? What's involved with getting it from your cotton or whatever else that you're beating it into to make your cloth out of it from there? And the other one is a major category of getting into the realm of making leather from getting an animal and to then getting the hide, because it talks about that there's the red tanned hides that kind of go over the tabernacle. So what's involved with getting into that? And the lastly, there's kind of the what we call in a general boat, you might say, production. And things related to like building, construction, blacksmithing, you know, moving stuff around, transporting. So those are kind of the major buckets of where these things are lumped into. So let's just kind of go through them. And, you know, this is what people thought 100 years ago. And so we have a question down here.
Well, I can tell you that I still want to do this, but just spinning wool, because he wants fine twined linen. And I studied about how to spin and how to dye. There's a lot of work that just goes into doing that alone. And when you want to make it fine, you have to pull. I mean, there's, and then you have to build the spinner. Me and my daughter made one, a handheld one. And it's amazing that he put all this into everybody's mind. And so everybody had to build the spinners. They had to know exactly how to work the wool. They had to know how to build a weaving machine so they can weave these curtains. And these are not small curtains. These
no,
are pretty
huge,
big curtains.
Huge curtains.
And you have to have a certain size of a weaving machine just to make the curtains alone. And it's a lot of work. A lot of work is involved just in making the curtains, just in making the clothes, because you have to make the fabric, and you have to do it according to his specifications.
Right.
And I also studied tanning. That's a lot of work. It's stretching and drying and cleaning and scraping, and it's every single day you're working and working at it. And I mean, this is a lot of work just for the leather and just for the curtains and clothing.
Yeah. Yeah, and the point here is, just like we were talking about before, these are what some people reflected upon as being, you know, what you can extrapolate from this. Because one of the things we've talked about a lot of times before that the Pharisees did is they took a lot of what happened in the tabernacle and with the priesthood and brought that into daily life. Because strictly, this is, you know, just a good example of where tradition goes and stuff. Because if we strictly go by what this says, the only thing that applies to us is verse 3 of chapter 35. That is it. And, you know, verse 2. Everything else in this discussion here does not apply to us at all because we have no tabernacle. So none of this applies to us at all. However, it's one of those things that as we look at the, you know, the underlying thoughts of that is with Shabbat, what, just like when God stopped, he wants us to stop. Now, what does that mean? Is there a lesson that comes from the instructions that God gave the priesthood and the people who were making the tabernacle when they were told to not be doing all this stuff to make the tabernacle on Shabbat? What did that mean? And does this apply at all for us today? Are some of the same things that went involved into each of these things apply to us today? I'm not saying they do, not saying they don't, but one of these things that we perhaps should at least take a look at is to stop and reflect. It's like when you're reading the Psalms and you'll see that little phrase that gets translated. A lot of translations just leave it as, in the Hebrew, Salah, you know, and it's been translated lots of different ways. Pause and reflect, stop, you know, contemplate, whatever. These are things to at least contemplate of perhaps how God is instructing through the tabernacle how to keep the 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, to keep that from creeping in to God's appointment with mankind. Perhaps what people thought about over the centuries went way too far. We're going to see that Yeshua had to go back and tighten the screws down because they were kind of loosening up the Torah far too much and letting all kinds of stuff in and then coming down on people because they didn't follow every little tradition that they had developed over it. But could these be guides? And that's why Paul, when he goes into it, says each must be convinced in his own mind about these things. Because some people may think of it as something that applies to them. Some people may not. And this discussion may be something to at least allow us to have a, you know, you might say mercy or understanding with people that we might encounter who do see that these expansions that tradition has done over time apply to everybody and must be stringently enforced as if God himself said them. So we can take that into a view of having understanding with people. And as Paul says in a number of places, not to specifically go out of our way to offend somebody if we know somebody might have a problem with it. So just some ways to get us thinking. So the first bucket we were talking, yes. Well, you know, for example, like in Romans 14 is one place where Paul talks about somebody who might be, he calls it weak in faith, weak in their trust in God. So that he uses the specific example of someone, you know, who's basically doesn't eat meat. And, you know, you can understand based on what we know about Roman culture why they may not have been eating meat, because maybe they thought that unless it was a specific koshering whatever, that it wasn't allowable. So Paul was saying, when you're dealing with somebody like that, you know, don't demean them, don't crush them down or whatever, because their understanding is not the same as yours. So with this discussion, we might just be able to understand, even if we don't agree and say, oh, these people went way too far with what they thought about these things, we can at least have some understanding of, well, what was under the hood. So like in the first bucket, when we're talking about like the field to loaf, there's like 11 of these 39 that kind of fall into this bucket. And the first four are in the idea of the field work. What is involved with, you know, you're talking about getting stuff into the bread for like the bread of the presence. So what might be involved with that? So they kind of lumped it into the four main buckets there of like plowing and reaping and sowing and also, you know, dealing with animals, you know, because in Exodus 23, something we had read earlier, which was another restatement of Shabbat, it said that even you let your ox and your donkey rest. So you're talking about your field animals. We see that in Exodus 20 as well. You know, your ox and your other animals, you let them rest. Your maid servant and your male servant, you let them rest. So this idea of the stuff that's working for you, your field animals, you let them rest. And the plowing and the sowing and, you know, reaping. And the reaping is one we see come up in the Gospels. You might recall that from Matthew chapter 12, right in the beginning part of that. That's going back to specifically where it says in Exodus 34, 21, that you stop, Shabbat comes, and it's rest for your workforce, even during the plowing time and even during the harvest. So you're catching the beginning and the end of your seasons here. Even the plowing time, okay, you might say, do we have to like plow today? Do we absolutely have to plow today, or could we plow tomorrow? But harvest time, and if anybody you know in the wine business, that gets a little bit more particular, but that's only particular for people who are concerned about specific metrics that they're working on, and they say, you got to pick today, and it's got to come in today. So get your folks out there in the field today. So that sort of pressure upon you to say, oh, it must come in today, and we cannot wait till tomorrow, could be upon a person. But God is saying there in Exodus 34 that even in plowing time and harvest, even in times where you say, hey, this stuff has got to get done, even at that time, you just say, you got to stop. So thus, the extrapolation came over time that even just the incidental, quote, harvesting, and you see that in Matthew chapter 12 with, you see Yeshua and his students are going through this grain field, And you see, some of them were like plucking the heads of the grain and eating them. And Luke actually expands that further in Luke chapter 6, verse 1, and said that they were rubbing the grain in their hands. So that kind of gets into another bucket of discussions there. But that was kind of not only reaping, but also threshing. So those are two elements that come in there. Now, again, those were extrapolations that come in there that took from what it literally says, hey, you don't plow and you don't harvest. So plowing, big agricultural operation. Harvesting, big agricultural operation. But this is someone walking through a field and grabbing something. So it was extended that that was to be harvesting as well. Now, one of the things that you'll note, if you go back and you read Luke chapter 6 and you read Matthew chapter 12, is that Yeshua is not sidestepping the fact that they did it and saying, okay, that's what they did. However, what he's saying is that, okay, your tradition says this, but what is an extenuating circumstance here? If you want to extend it this far to say that, quote, reaping is grabbing heads of grain as you walk by because you're hungry. If you want to take it that far, well, consider why someone may want to do that. Are they doing that for their own gain? Are they just like going by, filling up their bag and saying, okay, you know, I'm just having a little moonlighting operation. I'm going to go through and, quote, reap on the side. Or is there a specific need that had to be filled for why they were doing that? And that was something that Yeshua had to point out and say, hey, look, you know, if you read other writings of the time period, people came to a similar conclusion on such things, is that, you know, for like extreme hunger, you get the comparison there of, you know, Dawid, when he was like famished, they went to the even bigger extreme of going, and it's not related to Shabbat, but going to grab the bread. You know, might have been Shabbat the situation they were talking about, because that's when they changed out the bread on the bread of presence. So the bread that was coming off the table, they said, hey, well, instead of going to the priesthood, which is where it only should have gone, they said, I will pass it along to Dawid and his companions, because they were hungry. They were to the point of where that was a serious option. It's not like, let's see, we got this bread, but wow, those cakes are tasty. Look at them, they're stacked up high. Oh my goodness, they're good. I'm not going to eat what I got, I'm going to go for those. We get the picture in Scripture that this is not just a preference, but a necessity that forced this hand to come in. So when you encounter things like Mark chapter 7, where Yeshua is talking about, you know, you're teaching for doctrine the commandments of men, is your extrapolation of you shall not reap or you shall not harvest or plow, extrapolating that to incidentally going by and grabbing a head of grain and then rubbing it to get the husk off of it, have you then supplanted the word of God by saying that God said this? You cannot eat if you're famished, hungry, because of this extrapolation which God did not say. You're not engaging in agriculture because of an incidental grabbing of grain. The other kind of bucket going further into this, kind of three things fall under that is, so you've got, you're out there in the field and you get the grain, the grain's coming in, so now you got to deal with it. And three things go into this as kind of in the general realm of like grain processing. And in there is like the binding sheaves together, general harvesting sort of things you do, the threshing, which we just talked about, and winnowing, and then the sorting. So you got the binding the stuff together, baling, binding sheaves, the kind of things that are in the general realm of that. And in the wine industry, that would be picking it, putting it into a lug to take it to your gondola, to take it back to the winery. So those sorts of like bundling of stuff into some sort of agricultural unit. And in the realm of that, we talked about with the students as they were, quote, you know, threshing, or even, you might even say winnowing. It would be like if you were to toss it up and let the wind blow that away. Are you, you know, engaging in agriculture if there is the incidental use, like what the students were involved with? Or in the sorting sort of thing, as you were talking about, oh, this is good, this is bad, that comes into the realm of, well, some people will have an opposition to, if you put something out, if you choose the good from the bad stuff that is in there. You know, if you were to like go through a bunch of grapes, and there's some that are shriveled and some are moldy and this and that and the other, and you're picking off one and this or the other, some people may have a problem by taking that thing too far. Because when you think about it, in the temple, or even in the tabernacle, when they were making the showbread for the bread of presence, you know, and they're not bringing moldy grain in to make that. So they've taken all that stuff out. So when we're talking about nice, fine grain, they're not just bringing in whatever. They're, you know, as Yeshua told the parable of the sheep or the goats, or the sorting the good fish and the bad fish, this sort of selection process down that God wants the best, that's happened before the bread of the presence gets there. So, you know, there are some folk who might take that to the extreme of saying, you know, that you have to just put, if you're going to put something out there that you haven't pre-selected, you cannot then select anything from that. So just be aware of that. That might be, people might take that to the thing of whatever you might sort, don't be sorting on Shabbat. So just be aware of that. Now, when we think of the sorting process, that's also something that we think about with the clean versus unclean. That's one of the lessons that God is teaching with clean and unclean, is to pay attention to the things around you. Because some of those things out there that you may not notice may be, quote, unclean, so to speak. So into the general other, so you've got the, you've gotten this stuff out of the ground, you've made it into your grain process. You process the grain, you sort it out, now you're going to make your bread. So the four big chunks that come down from here is like the bread production, the grinding, the milling, the grating, the sifting or the straining of stuff that comes out of it. If you ever got involved with using a sifter, that sort of thing. The kneading of the bread, and also involved in that is the cooking, the baking, and the melting. Now, we've talked about that a bit here in this congregation before, about the cooking, the baking, and such like that. We know it specifically from Yom Kippur. But it's kind of in this general boat. So first off, with the grinding, the milling, and that sort of thing, that comes from the idea of not just making the bread, but also when we were going through a discussion of making the spices for the incense, that stuff had to be ground down because you took the wrong ingredients and you ground the stuff down into a fine powder, and it was all combined together and mixed together. So from the sense of, you're not making the incense for the tabernacle on Shabbat, so, and you're not, you know, mixing or getting your bread and milling that down into flour on Shabbat. So that's where that general bucket comes from. So that's where we think about into life. Do those things apply to us further on beyond that? So some people might think that there could be an issue with, even to the point of like grating cheese. So just be aware that some people may have an issue with that. Again, it's just to the point of, if you're around people who may have these sorts of challenges, to just be aware that it might be an issue. Yes.
I don't know if I'm understanding right, but what I think, I'm thinking that you're trying to say that if someone is weak, can someone be in the truth a really long time and really be clueless about something?
Sometimes, yes.
And then we're not supposed to say anything?
Just be aware at what string you're pulling, because you may be unraveling more than you think. I know I've had some people in my family that have held on to a erroneous belief for a very, very long time. But I know every time that I even tried to tug on that a little bit, I was pulling on their faith in God. So I tried to stay away from that as much as possible, nudge as I could. But again, God is the one who convicts on anything like that. If it's going to be convicted anymore, that would have to be God's doing.
Okay.
You know, it wasn't something that was like, you know, completely away from God. This was like in the extension category. Their idea of how God had extended his rules came down to from someone's suggestion to God's order. So thus they held to this as being God's order, that you must do this. You must do this. So to pull on that, this person I knew specifically, because talked with them about it, kind of a little nudging in the edges, realized that this was a big part of their belief in God. To pull on that further would have done damage to their trust in God.
Oh.
It's to the point of, oh, if this isn't what God said, what other things aren't what God says? So it's one thing of where wisdom, God's wisdom, has to come into play here. And when you're working with somebody, is that the traditions that they've come upon may be too closely linked to and become doctrines that come from God, the actual teachings that come from God. That is why Yeshua said that was so serious. Because if you are teaching for doctrines, what God says this, God says that, that are really just traditions of men, if you then have to correct those traditions, but those people think they are sin, they are rebellion against God, you know, you are teaching them sort of rebellion against God in their mind. Until God has changed their mind, they're going to be sort of, it's going to be in the back of their head, I may be rebelling against God. This is not right. This is not right. Until God changes their mind on those things, it may be still in the back of their head, I'm rebelling against God. That's why the Apostle Yaakov says that, you know, if someone thinks that something is a sin, it is a sin to them. Not that it becomes a sin for everybody, but for them, it is something that could come between them and God. I've seen that happen with quite a few people.
But the scriptures also say that if you see a brother in sin, you're supposed to go to them and talk to them. So you're saying not to say something you don't want to pull, but then you were supposed to. So how do you know you're doing?
You have to ask for wisdom in what is tradition and what is a false doctrine, a false thing that is actually going against their relationship with God. You know, if it is coming between them, you know, for a good example is that I can't believe God said that I can't do this. Well, if you just point out God didn't tell you can't do that. Oh, well now suddenly you have now turned God from being an ogre into God is God of freedom. Because he never told you to do that to begin with. See, that's the difference of like coming in and helping somebody with something that was hurting their relationship with God, that was only tradition, to actually kind of help and turn them around into something. But again, you have to be extremely careful on how you pull that string, because a lot can unravel. Yeah, well, we all have to ask for God's forgiveness on saying a lot of things that we really shouldn't. I know I've done that quite a lot. And, you know, it's one of those things that those painful memories always come up. It's like, can't believe I said that. I know that happens to me almost on a daily basis. So with this, and we can think of also in the one of the things that kind of comes into this idea we were talking about bread production is we were talking about kneading, you know, kneading the dough into something that works in bread. And you're, you know, kicking up, mixing the ingredients together, or if you add some sort of leavening agent or working the starter dough or whatever through it, you're working and kneading the dough. Now, generally, you know, the folks have extrapolated this further beyond anything which was anything at all, have taken this to mean you combine things that were a powder or something dry, you mix liquid into it and mix it together. That is what's thought to be behind that thing in John chapter 9, where Yeshua spit into the dirt, mixed that together into mud, and then put it on the guy's eyes. Because what is he doing? Dirt, dust, whatever, putting liquid into it, making mud, rolling it together into some sort of a paste and stuff, and then putting it on his eyes. And there's actually a whole long discussion in the Talmud about eye salve and Shabbat. Do you apply eye salve on Shabbat or not? You know, and how serious does the situation have to be to create eye salve? And actually, what you're talking about, what Yeshua does, is pretty much what they came to the conclusion. It's like, you know, if you have a life-threatening condition and such, yeah, you know, mercy trumps your ideas on this. Doesn't go as far as saying, look, we've extrapolated this far, so we can retract it back a little bit to for the sake of mercy. But just be aware that, like in John chapter 9, when he's working with this blind man, that you're wondering why on earth was that such a big deal? Is because this was part of those 39 buckets, or what they call fathers of work, that are considered to be treading upon Shabbat. So, you know, just... Yeah, blindness was like a pre-existing condition. And one of the things that was also part of that discussion in the Talmud is that was the eye injury happened that... Did it happen on Shabbat? So that you had to take emergency action, or was it happened before that time period? Now, what Yeshua did was he was working from somebody long pre-existing condition. So he was tightening the screw up quite a bit on that particular tradition and saying, look, you know, if you have the chance of doing mercy in the absolute way that God can just bam, do something and make it happen, the fact that you have some incidental, quote, kneading happening, look at the bigger picture of what God is doing here. Are you actually seeing God at work, or are you seeing someone tearing down God's house? That's where you see the wisdom of, like, Gamaliel's position is like, maybe God is doing something that we're not quite aware of. Something's happening here. We're just not quite aware of what's happening. The last kind of bucket of this, working with the bread to make it into production, is the cooking, boiling, baking. That really comes from when we went through Exodus chapter 16, was talking about the manna and the fact that it would come and there would be the double portion that would come on the sixth day, and it says boil what you're going to boil, bake what you're going to bake. Get everything together because there ain't going to be anything on Shabbat. And whatever you make is going to last through. So thus, that's where the tradition, you know, came, that this extends into. So this is where you say, okay, you have a firm peg of something that God specifically said here related to the manna, that it's coming. This stuff is coming. You make what you need to make for Shabbat, because you're not going to have it there. Now, we think of today, okay, we're not being fed out of the mouth of God every day like the manna was coming. We're not dependent upon some package that shows up on our door. You know, some of us might like packages that show up on our door, but we're not like, it must come or we die, sort of thing, like the manna is on it. You know, however, what is the thing that God was teaching? God was teaching about man will not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. And the one thing that Yeshua pointed out was that they ate the stuff that came every day, you know, 6 days a week, but they still died. They didn't continue on. It wasn't like there was this life, the everlasting life that God was going to provide came through this stuff that came down. That was something that God provided. But it's something that we live on God's words. So with this, you know, think of, is it a huge extrapolation to say that perhaps the, you know, preparation of food on Shabbat, as is talking the Shabbat Shabbaton, is a, you could say, a reasonable thing to say, hey, you know, back off on the really, you know, ramping it up to make stuff. I know, like, what I've seen in the tradition that I came from, that the full-on food production on Shabbat is a huge chore. In fact, it sticks with me over a long period of time. An assistant pastor's wife told me, like, Sunday is my day of rest because I just work like crazy on Shabbat. I mean, Shabbat was a huge production of food, and to the point of, you know, another congregation, they had to have a rotating schedule of families that were making it because it was just a burnout sort of thing, you know, because you end up, you missed out on all of the study, you missed out on this, you missed out on that, plus you're kind of work, and yeah, and the cleanings and stuff, because we're not just talking about a little bit, we're just talking about a huge amount of stuff, lots and lots and lots and lots of stuff. So again, we're getting back to this thing of what is it that God is telling us about our appointment that we have in time? Are there some things that are, you could say, taking away from the appointment in time? Now, all of us kind of know what those things are that take away from these things. And one of the things, going through this again, these are just what people thought hundreds of years ago, but they're kind of a good starting point to think of, you know, are we allowing our, quote, production of the tabernacle, unquote, to intrude upon God saying, hey, look, stop what you're doing the rest of the time. Pay attention to what I've done. That's really the point, because otherwise, if you're not really paying attention to the lesson of what all this is, then Shabbat becomes the chore, the drudgery that you end up seeing, like in Isaiah chapter 58, you cannot call the Shabbat a delight. You cannot call the day of the Lord a blessing, because it is just, it's just drudgery. Oh, it's like, you know, how many of these 39 things plus all the other myriad of things that come under the 39 things, and out of the myriad that come out of those that came out of the 39, you know, what have I, you know, done about this or not done about that? It's a starting point to think about the things that crowd into our life. As we in our modern life, you think, oh, we got so many things that can help us, you know, have more time. Do we have more time? Now, most people say they don't have more, they have less time than before. Even though we've got all these things that have removed all kinds of work out of our daily lives, yet we don't have time. Every minute is sucked up by something or other, whatever that might be. So one of these things of looking at the production of the tabernacle is to see if there are things that have kind of crept into God's appointment with us, because I was watching watching a program that really made a hugely, it was a huge point. It's like, this was an anniversary dinner, and the guy shows up for the anniversary dinner, and he's on his phone, you know, and he's getting a call, you know, and his work is calling, and this finally ends up leaving, right in the middle of the dinner. And you could just see the wife is just sitting there, like, dejected. It's like, you know, she looked forward to this thing, she dressed up, and you're going to a nice place like this, and just couldn't even give that 1 hour or 2 hours of there for that. And again, it's like, do we approach our appointments with God as drudgery or something that we look forward to? And, you know, too often we may look at our brothers and sisters in faith and say, oh, they live under slavery. But one ethic that does come through a preparation for Shabbat throughout the week is expectation of Shabbat. So is it the approaching dread of Shabbat, or is it the approaching joy of Shabbat? And that's something that each of us has to reflect upon. So we get into another kind of bucket, like 13 things kind of come under this of, call it like sheep to sheets. This is like you get the sheep out in the field, and now we're going to turn them into the sheets, the curtains, whatever we're going to do to put that in there. Into that, you get the major buckets of making the wool, weaving the wool, and then making the textiles and such. So under, you know, making the wool, you've got the shearing, you know, because obviously you get to get the wool. You can't exactly just sew the sheep into the walls. It might be kind of fun, but it'd be bad. Oh, sorry. But, you know, just keep in mind that the extension of that, some people have taken that into, like, some people might have a problem with haircuts or even shaving on Shabbat. Because they may think of, well, you're now doing that to yourself. You're shearing yourself. And that being an extrapolation from that. We may not have a problem with that, but just be aware that some people may. The other thing of, so you've gotten the wool or got whatever, your cotton out, and then you have to wash it. So thus, over time, it's been thought of just like it's been called just by the term like bleaching, but more in the sense of the washing, the wringing. Basically, it's like whatever it is that has some liquid in your wash, and then you wring it out. But oddly enough, you may see some people who do not have a problem with the actual washing of dishes. It's just the wringing of the rag or the sponge that's the issue. Because you're not actually washing the sponge. That's not the part of what you're doing. You're washing the dishes, not the sponge. Because, again, it's the extrapolation that you might take out of that. But then some people might extend that into actually bathing and showering and then kind of build that onto a place we're going to get to a little bit later that goes in with 35:3 about kindling a fire. They might say, extrapolate that out. Well, if I turn on the hot water, that's going to turn on, you know, get demand from the hot water here, which is eventually going to kick on the heater for the hot water heater. So then I kindle the flame by turning on the hot water heater, by the hot water on the thing. So just keep that in mind. That may be something that is a challenge for somebody.
So in the same lines, also the act of consuming water, of course, puts demand on the water system. The water agency, which of course uses electricity, which has to come from a power plant, which of course you fire the power plant up, which of course fire, and of course the great electricity to make all this stuff happen. So you can extrapolate really, really, really far.
Or just turn your water thing off on Shabbat, and then I think you'll get like one glass out of that. Yes. No, but truly, it's like one of those things that someone just may in their heart say, okay, I'm making the people down at the water plant or the electric plant or whatever, the natural gas plant, they have to work because I'm doing whatever.
All that thinking of what could be right or wrong is work to me.
Yeah, true. But, you know, it's just like one of those things that people have thought over time. What could this lead to? Sometimes too much of us go through life not ever contemplating anything of what happens or what it is that we're doing, what that leads to, you know. It's one of those things that we might just look at it and say, you know, mercy trumps this. There may be other considerations in there, but just to say, people have thought about this over hundreds of years, and people still do think about this today. So just to be aware of it, because you know, in some cases, we might not be convicted of specific things that are coming between us and God that other people do, but we may notice some things that are coming in between it. Are we demanding more of people that they should do stuff on Shabbat and not letting them have a Shabbat? Those are some considerations. I know that's been a challenge in my family for decades over that very issue of, you know, basically taking away someone else's Shabbat by what we do. Or say, or that kind of thing. So it's just one of those things to be aware of other people's concerns. So we talked about washing. Oh, yes. Okay.
So instead of saying something, we should just pray for them, right?
Yeah. Pray for them. You know, also talking a lot, because I know specifically with my relative who had this particular issue I was talking about, you know, I learned a whole lot about the depth of that person's relationship with God. Not shallow in the slightest, but there was that one little thing that was hanging on there that it was like one of those things that's like in the realm of things, it wasn't hurting the relationship with God, wasn't hurting others. Just let it go. It ended up being just something, just okay, sidestep it. Don't even touch it, because the ramifications were worse if you did. If God convicted, so be it. Other things that come into that are obviously you comb the wool or you comb the cotton to kind of get it ready for either the spinning or the dyeing. And the dyeing, you know, just keep in mind that some people might take that, the dyeing process for the linen or the wool into changing color of anything at any point in time, like painting, you know, dyeing your hair, whatever it is, touching up your hair, that might also come into play as well. So you know, spinning involved with that. Now, in the next major bucket involved with weaving, you got the wool. Now you weave it, and so thus we were talking about earlier. Obviously, these are huge curtains that are involved with this. So thus about stretching, you know, the warp and then preparing the loops and stuff for the woof of the loom. So, and then beyond that, then starting the weaving and then separating threads as you separate threads in the process of weaving. Now, just keep in mind that some people have extended the idea of this either separating the loops or weaving to such things as like needlecraft or braiding or basket making or making nets or something like that, where you're weaving or braiding something. So, you know, just be aware that some people might go in that direction with it. The next major bucket is with, okay, you've got the stuff, you've weaved into thread and such, so now you're going to make into actual cloth. So the four buckets that they have in there are tying, untying. That's just untying is saying, well, if you tie it, then if you untie it, then that would be just the unmaking of it. So kind of lump that in there too. Plus actual sewing. And then, you know, if you have to tear pieces of cloth to make other pieces of cloth into that. Now the bucket where the untying comes into, and we'll see the discussion of that in the Gospels itself, is in the realm of knots. There's a lot of discussion about tying knots. And one of the thoughts is that, well, if you're going to tie, you know, think of like when they talked about in our discussion that we read about all those pegs, all these brass, bronze, copper pegs for the tent all the way around. So, you know, if any of you ever put up a tent or had to tie down anything like that, you know, there's various knots involved with that. So one of the discussions that came through time is like, oh, what does it mean to make a knot? And so kind of the general consensus of that came down is that if it's called a quote permanent unquote knot, If it's something that's going to last for maybe a couple days or something like that, if you're going to a campsite and you tie down your tent or your stakes or your fly or whatever, and you are going to be there for a few days, that's, quote, permanent knot. It's surviving. But a temporary knot, like a necktie or tying your shoes or something like that, that's going to come undone. You're probably going to undo it a couple times a day. You might undo it. It just gets too stuffy, whatever. That's considered like the temporary knot. Now, that was applied, and we'll see it in the Gospels in just a moment, with a particular thing that was a part of this consensus decision on temporary knots. Yes?
So where would that stand with when you were making your sukkahs and sukkot? I mean, would you want a more permanent knot for at least this few days that you're going to be there, or...
Well, unless you want it to come down. I mean, I wouldn't recommend slip knots on your...
Okay, but you're not supposed to do permanent knots on Sabbath, and it would be a Sabbath.
You know? Oh, I mean, yeah.
That's where I'm going with that.
I'm just
curious.
I guess the idea is that, you know, the folks that would have a challenge with permanent knots would probably do that before a Shabbat, where there would be... the Shabbat Shabbaton, where you'd be cutting off work of this sort, you know, do that before. Remember, this main bucket is talking about the Shabbat Shabbaton, which is specifically the seventh day Shabbat and Yom Kippur, which is, you know, Shabbat Shabbaton, Shabbat Shabbat, Shabbat Shabbaton. You just cease. Now, the thing about the temporary knots, where we see that discussed in the Gospels, and it was actually a discussion that came in some other writings of the time period. You see it in Luke chapter 13, verses 15 and 16, where it says, you know, it kind of related to a healing that Yeshua did on a Shabbat. And so he answered them, "You hypocrites, does not each of you on the Shabbat untie his ox or his donkey from the stall and lead him away to water him? And this woman, a daughter of Abraham as she is, whom Satan has bound for 18 long years, should she not have been released from this bond on the Shabbat day?" So that was a determination that folks had also, you know, come to and saying one specific exclusion. And if you're saying the temporary knots, okay, fine, unloose those. But specifically also related to animals, to take them to get water, because that's cruel. You know, if they're thirsty and you keep them tied up and don't give them water, that's pretty cruel. That's hardly giving them rest. You know, you take them from toil and then put them into torture. So not great. So Yeshua then compares that as saying, like, well, look, you folks have realized that for mercy's sake, that on Shabbat you can untie an animal and take the animal to get some water. Well, why not then someone who's, quote, bound, has this condition for a long, long period of time? You might say, oh, this might be sort of the, quote, permanent knot, unquote. And for mercy's sake, shouldn't we untie that one too? Especially when you're talking, again, about the power of God. See, again, it's like when you're talking about the discussion in Hebrews 3 and 4, will you enter my rest? Will you see me at work? Will you see the land that I'm taking you to? Will you see rest when I give it to you? And will you enter it? So, if you see the power of God at work, like you see with these miracles, and you especially see with this woman who people had known and had the problem for a long period of time, would you then not allow her to enter rest and see that rest is coming through the power of God? Again, it's the pay attention to what is actually happening, what God is actually teaching, you know, not what it is that you've extrapolated what God says to say. To put "thus says the Lord" into something that people have said, well, what God meant by this was blah, 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 blah. So when people say what God meant by this may be true, maybe not, maybe helpful, maybe not. But to mix those two together and say that God said something when he really didn't, maybe good, maybe helpful, but not specifically a command from him, and then to bar someone from mercy or such because of that, takes that now a step further in the direction away from what God's real intent was on this. So we're going through the textile making. So now into another general bucket of making animal leather. So with animal leather, first you got to start with an animal. So thus they put it into the general buckets from that of you have to get the hide, then you have to make the leather, then if you're going to be using that for parchment or for the skins of the tent itself or for parchment to write on, then that comes from that. So getting the hide, you've got the trapping, the slaughtering, and the skinning. To make the leather, you've got the tanning, the scraping, and the cutting. And again, you know, you think about ways that people can extrapolate that further, but one of the things that is really good to keep in mind in the realm of making parchment, you know, think of the old, one of the main ways of parchment, you know, parchment being a skin, an animal skin that was used to write on.
Now,
oftentimes sheep, yeah, it was the sheep one. So another thing that was commonly used at the time period is papyrus or papyrus, which is it's reeds. They take reeds and they basically weave the reeds into like a fabric, which is amazing how long papyrus lasts, because we actually have good segments of the Gospel of Yohanan or John, which comes on papyrus, but it's another thing that people wrote on. Another, obviously, you had copper or some sort of metal that people engraved upon, but that's costly, takes a lot of time. Also, yes, or something like that. Or you also had people, clay, be another thing that people would put markings on clay and then bake them, but that's an involved process as well. Yeah, yeah. Before you cooked it, you could erase. So that's why you might see that some folks have the get a little concerned about actually writing. So the idea of the whiteboard would be bad because you're writing and erasing and doing so continually, and that idea, again, is an extrapolation several times down from where you started with this. But just keep in mind, you know, if for some people, even touching a pencil, which is used to write, is then a step towards, a step towards work and a step towards violation from God. Now, for that person, that is. And to move toward it is a move away from God. But, you know, again, in this whole section that we're looking at, there are very few God says to everybody, to all the sons of Israel, this is what you do. You know, most of what we're looking at in this section were to two guys, and then, you know, people who help them and people who will be serving in the tabernacle themselves. But when we look at what Shabbat is related to, these are kind of the guidelines, the things involved with the, making the tabernacle, setting it up, are the things that are kind of lumped into the realm of what a work is on that. So lastly, the bucket that we'll be getting to is production. So under that, you've got, you know, building, demolishing, that's pretty much self-explanatory. Things that you are, key thing to that is you're putting up something that's going to be lasting. And you're tearing down something that is lasting, you know, because it's the unmaking of something that's lasting. So that's why when you see this idea of the actual putting the whole tent up itself, no, that's not something that Shabbat should be for. Because again, tabernacle, kind of like this mini picture of God's throne, God's His realm, and also a picture of, you could say, the making of earth in just this small little bit, which is Shabbat is a memorial of really both. God making his embassy on earth, the first two embassies, which would be the first man and the first woman, and, you know, also that great realm of making the whole earth. So he did all that in 6 days, and so the memorial of all that is the seventh day, and that's the lasting one. And other memorials to what is involved with that and related to Shabbat providing rest gets layered on top of that. But with one of those other things that we come across that is related to this, of the connection, we're saying, like in 35 verse 3, it says, do not kindle a flame in any of your dwelling places. Well, there was also saying, well, you also kindle a flame related to all this metal stuff that you're doing. You think about all the metal stuff we were talking about, the hammered stuff, the cast stuff, all this stuff that you're going to be making with fire, and any of the heating that you're going to have to do for washing and such, that's all involving fire. So thus you're saying, even without verse 3 of chapter 35, God's saying the stuff related to kindling fires, and then the converse of that, extinguishing fires, was what people extrapolated from that, from this building of the tabernacle. And also involved with production is another thing, and we'll see another touch point of this in in transportation, because you think about, you're going to make the stuff, you're going to have to move the stuff around. So if you're going to make it in one place, I mean, sure, you could just make it in one particular place, but if you think that, you know, we talked about all these bases for the stands of the poles and whatever, you know, you could cast them in place all over the place, but that's ridiculous. If you're going to do something efficiently, and these folk likely worked efficiently, you're going to make it in one place and move it somewhere else. So it's like, from that, you came into the realm of, don't take anything that you're making or that is useful for doing something and then move that somewhere else. So thus, that can be taken down as far as some people will have a problem with carrying your keys in your pocket when you go out of your house, that, or whatever you might be picking up to take with you to go out. So that might be something that they see as objectionable. And that's also where a couple of other things come down is, you might have heard about the challenge or what people have about making transactions on Shabbat. Well, that is extrapolated out of this idea of carrying something around, carrying something of value, because you are carrying money, you're carrying something to make a transaction with, carrying somewhere else and then doing a transaction. And that also comes out of the idea of the Ten Commandments, where they talk about don't, you know, have the people that are working unto you by extrapolation. There are people within your gates, your maidservant. So people extend that to people who are working for you under some sort of a relationship. Don't engage in that on Shabbat. Let that other person rest. Don't engage in that. And you see shades of that show up in the prophets in the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, where they were, you know, having to kind of re-educate people on to the process of what Shabbat was all about, and having a challenge with people sitting outside, the merchants sitting outside of the gates, waiting until the sun went down so then they could all come in to do commerce. Because it's kind of like the idea of, you're carrying, people are carrying money to you, some other person is carrying goods to you or a service or something like that. And you see it in the Gospels. Remember the guy about the getting upset because he's carrying his mat? Well, that's where this comes from. It comes from extrapolating that thing of carrying stuff around in the tabernacle to make it, to saying, you know, you with your mat, you cannot carry it from one place to another. And, you know, going long distances is extrapolated from that as well. Yes, take up your mat and walk. So that's one of those things where you have the extrapolation butting up against an act of God and mercy. Because, you know, you're saying, okay, you have this teaching where someone has extrapolated this from making the tabernacle to now you cannot take up what you were laying on and now take that up and go home with it. Well, you've now seen God just work a miracle right in front of your face. Perhaps God has something to say about take up your mat and walk. So that's one of those things that it's very important that we pay attention to what Yeshua said about, you know, teaching for doctrine the traditions or commandments of men. That we don't do that. Anything that we can extrapolate from what God specifically says should not take precedence over what God is actually doing and, you know, getting in the way of people's relationship with God. And some possibly think that this could be behind, you know, you may have read that passage in the 1 Corinthians chapter 16, verse 2, where Paul gives that instruction about, you know, save up what you want to save up for the contribution on the first day of the week. And then when I come to you, we'll collect it. You know, the idea being that, okay, based on this thing, you're not carrying money around. So you're not, when you're getting together, if you come together on Shabbat or whatever, you're not bringing money with you. So just come by tomorrow and drop it off or whatever like that. So that's where some people think that comes into play with that. So, that is kind of the major bulk of the things that people have thought over time as to extrapolations from the passage that we just read into saying what is God actually talking about don't do any of the stuff that you've done throughout the week, and even stuff that you could say is God stuff that may be coming in between you and God because kind of busying yourself and burning yourself down with stuff that you might just kind of leave to another day, either do it before or do it after, just so that you keep that appointment open. And like think of like having an anniversary dinner or something like that. So that is kind of just an overview of it. Now, just in the realm of what we're kind of looking at, in Exodus chapters 25 through 40, through the end of it, Exodus 25 through 40, you can see is just the general realm of it is like worship of God and the things that are involved with that. So the major buckets of that are the instructions about worship. You get that in chapters 25 through 31. Then about this idolatry. So you've got how God says you should worship. Then you've got chapters 32 through 34 about the golden calf and all that stuff. So God says, this is how you should worship. Then the people go off and do something else. And so this then big chunk that from 35 through 40 about the tabernacle and all this stuff is saying, okay, I've told you how you should really show your appreciation for me, how we can connect together, how I am to be treated as separate and part of how I'm making you separate from the world. Now he says, okay, this is build the house that is going to be a real symbol of the separateness of this place from the rest of the world. God says, I'm going to put my presence here in this particular house. And it is to then be a service to the area around it. So thus, when you see Shabbat then is a thing of the presence of God being with you in that particular place, that particular time, kind of like an appointment. And then also you see that taken by extension by the Apostle Paul when he talks about that we are ambassadors for the Messiah. And that can take in our embassies with us wherever we go. Kind of like the mobile tabernacle. We are taking the house of God as the greater house of God. Each little individual a dwelling of God now going throughout the world around us. So with Exodus here, it seems like all sorts of arcane details, but what it's really referring to, it's giving us a picture of an actual place. So we can, you know, not just say, okay, there was a tent out there and it was great. It was wonderful. It was awesome. But actually describing what this thing looked like and then actually kind of giving you some pictures of gold and silver and what the colors were, how fine the workmanship of this was, that this was, it kind of pains me sometimes. You probably have seen it in either some sort of quote history unquote program or some sort of Bible program where they depict the tabernacle as kind of like, you know, some ratty old cloth kind of draped over something, and this box that's kind of looks like it was painted with spray paint or something like that. It kind of looks like, wow, these people just threw this together and they just were like, you know, you get the picture of this. Of like, there's a lot of unbelievable work that went into this. This wasn't people that just kind of bunch of sun-stroked sheep herders out there that threw stuff together, but they were doing something beautiful. And when people ooh and ah when you see the stuff that comes out of like Tutankhamun's tomb, and you see the sarcophagus, and you see the chairs and the chariots and stuff like that. That was the culture that these workmen came out of. So we can think of that the workmanship that went into this thing was at least on par with that. At least on par with that. And you see in the description of details that these people had that idea of that kind of, you say, high finish approach to workmanship that was likely going into this. So this was not some sort of shack, not some lean-to somewhere. This was a beautiful place. So, I mean, think of the God taking our sukkah and transforming that into a beautiful dwelling place. That's something that we should just pray for. And the great promise of the new covenant, and especially expressed there in Ezekiel, is that he's going to give us a new heart and a new spirit within us, and to transform us from what we were before into something just utterly beautiful. So going from a shack to this beautiful mansion. Any last thoughts as we close out here today? Yeah, again, you know, this again is a reflection of people hundreds of years ago. You know, you could see that Yeshua had to tighten up a number of these things because they just went way too far and took people away from God. But again, it can get us thinking into what is it that we are doing, not only on Shabbat, but in the rest of our lives, that is coming between God and us? Are we filling our life with too much stuff? So let's close with prayer. Father, we thank you for giving us your instructions through time, and we thank you for also giving us wake-up calls when the things that we do that we think that we're helping you actually may be coming in between us and you. And Father, we thank you for having mercy on us as we learn and grow and realize what it is you're doing, and help us to have mercy on other people that we think may not be getting with the program. Father, we thank you for the change that you're doing in us, taking us from the little tent we used to be into a beautiful tabernacle. We thank you for these things in the name of your Son, Yeshua. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions, or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. Hallel.info.